Mr. Old Reel 3, we're talking about when you went out to join HMS Scotia, the shore station, training station at Ayr, or in the hills around Ayr. And we've looked up the dates now, and you were called up in August, and you'd been at Royal Arthur until September, and then you went to Scotia in September, and you were there till March 44.
Right.
That's from your career form. Right. Now, what happened when you arrived?
Well, first of all, I'll tell you from when we left. we were put on these like tracks from Royal Arthur and taken down to the station, Skegness Station, and on a train. And I would assume we went via London, but we might not have done. But anyway, we were all pushed into these carriages. And, of course, what pleased us most, along came the guard and locked all the doors from the outside. We never know whether it's to stop us getting out or to stop the girls getting to us at the time. And we were all young 18-year-olds, of course, we hoped for the best. But, yeah, we arrived eventually at Scotia Air Station. And then I would imagine we were taken up by truck again, this I can't remember, to Air Station, Scotia, to HMS Scotia. Again, it was quite a nice, comfortable looking place, well out into the hills, by the sea. And again, we were put into chalets, being that it was an ex-Butlins holiday camp. But the regime was a little bit harder there. We were woken earlier in the morning for re-rally, and most of the bathrooms were cold water and not hot water. There was a lot of people there, and then after you went to your wash and shave and everything, then you went to the halls and had your breakfast. I'm not really sure what came first, whether it was the parade each morning before, it must have been after breakfast, I would have thought, that every morning you were on parade. There was parade ground for what they call divisions, where you had inspection, and it was a little bit more like the Royal Navy as such then. Then you had to go to whatever class you were doing. Some were telegraphists, like in training, like my branch, and some were bunting tossers, signalmen. But all you did all day long was Morse.
Now, how did they teach you Morse code training?
Well, we were all sitting, as you would in a schoolroom, behind desks, and you each had a Morse key, and the instructor was sitting at the desk like a schoolmaster normally would. And he would, from the beginning, just teach you ordinary Morse and what each letter was. But then after that, he would send individual messages to each person, and you would have to answer that and send a message back. There were times when you went to different classes where you learnt about the types of set, which I can't remember anything about, but you learned how to tune in, how to calibrate to a certain degree, but 90% of your time was reading Morse.
Now, did you have a natural ear for Morse? Because some people can sort of hear almost like music and go very quickly. And
no, this was the difficulty I found. It's all right with ordinary plain language. Even now, I can pick up a piece of paper and read it in Morse. The training was so good. And I would even, I believe, be able to read Morse to a certain degree if I listened to it. It'd have to be very slow, of course. The difficulty came with numerals. These are many numerals are like some of the alphabeticals, but with just an extra spot extra dot or less dot or something like that. And the worst was the mixture of alphabeticals and numbers, where you've got a code, and therefore if you've got something like an H, which is four dots, then you've got an S, which is three dots, or a number, which is number five. You know, they're very similar, and if you're doing it slowly, but you're expected to pick, you're supposed to receive this at 30 words a minute. And there's no way I could do this, even at the end. In the end, I and many others failed the course. So even after 6 months, with really very good training, that is, some of us just couldn't do it. It wasn't possible.
How about sending? How were you at sending?
It's easy enough to send it. I mean, you just send it with the ordinary Morse key at that time, and not a side key, a vertical key. And it's easy enough to do that.
So you could send at 30
I could send. Well, you can send, but of course you know what you're sending. So it's easy, you know, no matter. You can send, and this is one of the problems. People sending would send it as fast as they possibly could. So they might be sending you a message at over 30 words a minute, and I believe it's very difficult to receive it. I found it very difficult to receive it at that speed.
Did different operators have a different fist? I mean, could you tell who was sending it, by the way, or did you not get as far as...
Well, I never got as far as that, but this is so. You can pick an operator by the key. I learnt a lot, but I just was not able to receive it at the percentages. I believe they wanted about 70% good quality at 30 words a minute receiving, and it's very, very difficult.
Did you enjoy Morse code and the training, or did you find it...
I did like it, and this is what seems strange to me. I really liked it, and I would have been happy doing it, but I think another thing that was a bit of a deterrent, it's such a nice place up there in Ayrshire, and everybody were so good. I mean, it was one of the best places you could ever go to. You know, the people were...
The local people?
The local people.
How did you get on with them? Because people really don't always get on with the local population.
Especially if you're in the services. They used to bus us into the town. When you went on shore leave and you caught the Liberty boat was the local bus. And you went into town, there was conductors on there. And we were all young lads, and you can imagine the ribald comments, and all away from home for the first time, and the way we must have acted, and how some of those who were not that much older than us ever put up with it, I just don't know. And you'd pick up the same, well, a bus again in the bus garage in the town about, I suppose, 10 o'clock at night when your leave ended. And you got the same sort of thing, and these conductors were, you know, quite happy going along with that. None of them took any offence about anything that went on, you know. It's amazing.
But what about in the town? What would you do in there?
In the town, the first thing I noticed is when I first went into town, there's a church just right in the town, Church of Scotland, of course, and they've got an open door. You could go in there at almost any time. You could have a cup of tea or coffee if you was a serviceman. You could have a bun, and there was no talk of religion. They just spoke to you, and, you know, it was lovely. And from most of the pubs you could go into, and because you was in uniform, of course, you were old enough, as far as they're concerned, to drink. And there might have been a certain amount of trouble, but I never saw any actual trouble myself there.
Did you drink much, or were you just going in for a pint? You wouldn't have much money, would you?
No. The money was very, very low, and of course you were on your lowest rate anyway, because you were just training, and that was it. But very often, the Scotsman, he'd buy you a drink, the slightest... the slightest sign. I mean, it's all about Scotsmen, but in fact, I was there over to Christmas, 1943, and I went into a pub there, and I had several of the men there, two or three, had several of the men there, offers drink. In the end, I had to wait when they wasn't looking and tip some down the sort of aspidistra type of thing by the side of me. I didn't like to, but, because if you said no, no, come on, you're in the Navy, you're in down in this town, and that sort of thing. They had wonderful there, had a wonderful time. I don't think that helped the training very much.
Now, what about your instructors? I forgot to ask you about them. How good were they? I mean, you said, were they sympathetic to your problems? And some of the others, you said you weren't the only one to fail, lots of you failed.
Mm.
Were they good instructors? Could they understand the problems you had and help you with it? Or were they a bit in...
I don't think any of that come into it. There's so many people coming through training and they had to get as many as they could through. And it didn't matter, even if you weren't paying attention, I don't think they noticed it. All they were there for was to put the message out, try and teach as many of you as possible the course within the course of 6 months, and that was it. I don't think they had time to do anything.
So you didn't get individual attention?
No, not really.
So basically they were just putting a lot of people through this course knowing that a percentage would fail.
Yeah, must have been.
What percentage would fail your lot?
I can't remember, to be quite honestly, but I wasn't the only one, but there are a few, and I've spoken to people elsewhere, and they've said, this happened. But this is the thing. I think even in other branches, there's quite a lot of failures.
How did you get on with the other recruits?
Well, I'm lucky. I make friends easily, and a very small minority of people that I don't get on well with. There is always the odd person who shouldn't have been in the Navy anyway, I think, if they don't get on, Because when we come to talking about carrying on board the ship, you know how many, you've been told how many are together in a little cubicle anyway.
Well, good. Now, were there any bullies or any bullying? This is in training, I mean.
Not that I notice in training, no. I know you hear about this, but I've never come across it.
And what about the officers? Did you see much of them?
Not when you're in training. The only time you see the officers is when you're on the parade ground in the mornings for, drill perhaps, or the morning... parades.
What was the discipline like? I mean, you said the whole regime was tougher. What was the discipline like?
Well, it wasn't too tough, but you had always to salute an officer if you saw an officer, and you always had to call the petty officers as petty officer. Jones or whoever it was, and if you speak for an officer, it was always sir, and it was enough discipline, I would have thought, without it being too much discipline. I'm quite happy with discipline, a lot of people are not.
What about kit inspections? How strict were they? Laying out your kit and that sort of thing.
Well, in your training here, it wasn't that important. I'll tell you more when we got into Ganges.
Anything else about your time at Scotia, then, HMS Scotia?
Well, we always noticed it was very cold, because it is a cold part of the world, and but it was very pleasant, and it was one of the best places, there is another one, that I was at while I was in the Navy, I think.
Now, your next post, you seem to have gone back to Royal Arthur in March 44.
Right.
And then to have been made an ordinary seaman and then went to the Ganges in April. So you seem to have been back for about a month.
Yeah. What happened was when one or two of us failed or didn't pass, I wouldn't like to say failed because we only just failed, they then said, well, as you haven't failed by very much, you have the option to go through the course again if you want to. And I said, well, I've come to fight a war, you know, I didn't volunteer to go back for another 6 months course. They said, well, there are other options, which they told me about. And they said, if you want to, you can be a seaman's branch, change from the communication branch to become a seaman's branch. And then that will give you other options as sub-trades for that. So I agreed to that, and I was sent down with another chap who I can't remember the name of to I can't think of the name of it now. What's the next one on?
Well, the Royal Arthur.
Royal
for
Arthur.
A month.
That's right. Went back to Royal Arthur because you have to go back to Royal Arthur because that changes you. This brings you in as a from the street, and it also changes you to different rates. So spent about a month there, just more or less in transit to become a seaman. And then after that, went with perhaps just one or two other people on their own, each one in charge of the other type of thing, to Ganges.
At Shotley.
At Shotley. And that is where the trouble started. It's
so
tough.
You went there in April 44, and you were there till July.
Yeah.
Now, how did they take you in there? This is a very different establishment, isn't it?
It's a very different establishment. This is the first of the real strict discipline. You go in there, and you have to do everything strictly to the book. And even your sports, you have to go in for whatever sports they want you to go in for. If they want you to do football, you will do football. They even take you at one time into the gymnasium, and you have to box with somebody. Very often you don't like it, but you don't like boxing, but you have to box with somebody. They throw about four of you in the ring, and you have to box with each other till one decides that that's enough and he's out of the ring. And if you do anything wrong at all, there's a hill there, I forget what it's called, I've read about it again with the name, where you run up and down this hill with a gas mask on. And that's not very good.
Did that happen to you?
It didn't happen to me, but I knew, because I always tried my best not to get into trouble. You can't win in the Navy if you're a troublemaker. It's not a good thing. But I know the sort of thing that it might be, because at the top of this hill was the building where they used to test the gas masks. And you would go in there with a gas mask, they had tear gas in there, and then when you got halfway through, you had to take your gas mask off. So you knew what tear gas was like.
What was it like?
It wasn't very good. I didn't like it.
What was your accommodation like?
The accommodation
was
is...
Was it huts or barrack rooms or what?
Not bad. They were Nissen huts. I think there is a slight difference in accommodation, but most of them are in long Nissen huts with the ordinary single bunk beds or laid side by side. You've got a locker at the bedhead end, and every Saturday morning that Nissen hat has to be spotlessly clean. You have to polish the floor, you have to polish all the cans, all your kit has to be laid out for inspection, and the officer of the day or whoever he is.
So tell me about how would you clean the hut out?
Well, first of all, this is a long time ago, so I can't be sure I'm absolutely correct, but the beds themselves are movable, so they would be moved, I believe, to one end, perhaps. The floor is all parquet flooring, it's wooden flooring, and It's polished with what they call a buffer. It's a big.
What's that?
By
People
hand.
Don't know what is a buffer. They don't know what they are.
A buffer, as far as I can recall, is a heavy, flat, like a cushion, I suppose, on a pole, and it is pushed all over the floor to polish. I can't ever remember putting any polish on the floor, but I should imagine that must happen. But when you polished it with these buffers, it came up, you know, like a dance hall. It was really good. And that I do remember, because that used to happen every Saturday. And the cans, they were polished.
The cans?
Well, all the tins. You had all sort of tins that you get food. Although you ate at the, like, I don't like to call them cafeterias, because they're not cafeterias, the places to eat. But the cans in these Nissen huts, I'm not sure whether they were just there for show. I can't ever remember them being used, but I can remember them being cleaned and polished. So I can imagine that's... And your kit, when it's laid out, has to be perfect in the exact position.
How would you lay it out? Was it on your bunk?
No, you're on your bunk. It had to be laid out on your bunk. And, well, some of it had to be laid out on the bunk. Things like shoes and some other items, I think, if I remember right, used to be laid out at the foot on the floor of the bunk. And, of course, every piece was checked. If you had anything missing at all, you were in trouble. If anything was not clean, you were in trouble. And if everything was not folded correctly, you were in trouble.
There was a method of folding everything.
There was a correct method that was laid down, as it must be folded, so like that. And if I remember right, it wasn't only the clothes that you were using, it was your full kit. You had a full kit. You had uniform that you wore, which was probably the working one, which is a number 3. You had your best one, which was a number 1. I think there was a number 2. I can't remember where that fits into the scheme of things. But then, of course, you had a duck suit, which you would wear when you went out east, or supposedly when you go out east. All those had to be laid out, even if they were not the usual thing to be used. Your shoes had to be polished.
Now, how far? I mean, you know, there's different levels of polishing. There's sort of mad polishing where they, you know, they do both sides and underneath and everything, the nails. I mean, was it really excessive, the polishing?
Not really. In the Navy, you have shoes. The boots are only for some occasions. I can't remember whether boots were part of the kit at that stage. But the shoes are like the shoes you would normally wear anywhere. Anyway, there's nothing special. They're nice, comfortable shoes, and you just polished them so that they look clean. There was no excess,
so
like an army.
That wasn't excessive?
No, not excessive at all.
What about polishing buttons on various bits?
No, because you never had buttons on. Ours was a square rig. A square rig is just got a collar, not the suit type, which is fore and aft rig.
Now, in the olden days, they'd done quite a lot. Sailors used to like to tiddly up their uniforms and do little adaptions. Would that have started at this stage when you were at Ganges, or would that be later on board Caron?
It would have to be later on, because anything at all at Ganges, you would be really be in trouble about. Your collar had to be as pasa, they call it, which had to be dark blue as it was provided to you. Your shirt had to be white, because you had a white T-shirt for summer wear and a blue jersey for winter wear. But that shirt had to be white with a dark blue bit along the top. And your tiddly suit, yeah, that came later. You were not allowed...
We'll talk about that when you're on the
Caron. We'll talk about that later on, yeah. You'd be in trouble with anything, because you didn't get much leave in Ganges.
Now, what was a typical day's training like then? How you said it was worse or stricter. How would the day start, and what sort of training? You were training as a seaman now,
That's
not
right.
as communication. So,
no. Your training as a seaman was not one singular thing, really, like a telegraphist. It was mostly learning how to send and receive and just looking at Somerset. As a seaman, you have to do everything. You have to be able to take over the person's job next to you if he gets killed, because you never carry any extra men on ships in the Navy, especially small ones. So you have to do everything. So you learn gunnery, torpedomanship, you learn all about the different types of shells.
Well, hang on. Let's start with the actual seamanship part first.
All right.
You know, I'll come back.
Yeah,
well, I mean, seamanship, as it, I mean, that's knots and splices, rowing cutters, boxing the compass, all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Did you do much of that, what they call old-fashioned seamanship?
Yeah, everything. Everything was that. In the Ganges, you learnt the old type of seamanship. Nothing else but the old type. So you'd probably go into the classroom one day and learn how to box the compass as part of the day anyway. And another day, if it's reasonable outside, you'd learn how to heave the lead, which was quite a traumatic experience.
Could you tell me about that? Because that's not something we've heard about.
Well, heaving the lead, you do it one at a time, with everybody having a good laugh and a bit of a worry when it's their turn. If I can remember correctly, you had almost like a mountain block that they used for horses in the old days, a concrete thing with about three steps that you climbed up with a rail around it at the top. So you was almost as though you was on the deck of a ship, and you were given this long lump of lead, which is about a foot long, with a long rope on it, you call it in those days, and along the whole, it was a long rope, quite a few fathoms, and you were already told about this. You were told that in the bottom of the lead, it has a dent, a hole, more or less a piece out of it, and tallow is put in there so that when the lead touches the bottom of the sea, it's brought back, it collects sand or shells, so it will tell them what's on the sea bottom. And the rope on the lead is divided into like knots or bits of leather or bits of material. So you stand on this concrete structure and you have the loop of rope in one hand, usually I'm left-handed, but fortunately I use the right hand, because I nearly always do it just right-handed. And your right hand, you have part of the length of the rope with the lead. Now you have to swing this lead on the end of the rope till it's almost horizontal, and then you have to swing it around your head without it coming down and hitting you on the head. It can be done, but it can be difficult. And you learn how to heave this lead so that it goes right forward, and then when the ship comes up to it being vertical, you will be able to read from this line that's protruding above the water a mark on it. So you say, by the Mark 7, or by the, whatever it is. And it is very tricky to do.